This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Kalamazoo County is considering a local ID program. Coming up, Sevilla Mann talks with the director of the Synod Community Center in Ypsilanti, which helped create an ID program in Washtenaw County. But first,
do you agree that global warming is a hoax?
I do not, Senator.
So Donald Trump is wrong?
I do not believe that climate change is a hoax.
That is Oklahoma State Attorney General Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, being questioned by Senator Edward Markey during a confirmation hearing yesterday. We're going to talk with two members of the Climate Change Working Group at Western Michigan University. David Caro is a professor of biological sciences, and Paul Clements, a political science professor at Western. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us, Gordon.
Thank you.
Your group has expressed a lot of concern about Scott Pruitt as the head of the EPA, potentially, assuming he's confirmed. Did yesterday's hearing do anything to calm your fears?
Not at all. And actually, that quote is, it really doesn't say that he will do anything to combat climate change. What he said is that he believes that climate change is happening. That's not the issue. It's 100% certain that climate change is happening. The question is why? And he did not say that he believes that humans have any contribution to climate change, when in fact it's very likely that we are causing close to 100% of current climate change.
100%. Is there any wiggle room in there that it could be less than that? Because we do know that there are fluctuations in the Earth's temperature that happen outside of human activity.
Right. Up until 1900 or so, all climate change in the history of the planet was due to natural factors, and really one natural factor, which was changes in the amount of solar energy reaching the planet. Those changes happen as a consequence of changes in our orbit, the tilt of our axis, and the position in our orbit when the northern summer occurred. Those are well understood. They cause changes over tens of thousands of years, not over a century. And natural climate change all boils down to changes in solar radiation. Turns out that since 1975, while Earth has been warming at the fastest rate in probably 55 million years, the sun's energy has been decreasing. So there's really no natural factor that can explain any of current climate change.
You know, what our group is concerned about is government depends on the authority of science. Everything we take for granted of what government does depends on the scientific underpinnings to understand what's actually happening. And the science is very clear on this, that we need to be taking even more rapid action than what we're taking. And, you know, when Donald Trump says climate change is a Chinese-inspired hoax, he puts a lot of room in there for you can kind of not quite go that far. But Scott Pruitt, his entire record, as well as his comments at the hearing yesterday, demonstrate that he is a climate science denier. And those of us who are in institutions that depend on the authority of science, we should be saying this is just not acceptable.
Let me read a quote from him yesterday. Science tells us the climate is changing and human activity in some manner impacts that change. The ability to measure and pursue the degree and the extent of that impact and what to do about it are subject to continuing debate and dialogue. Now, we've covered the first part of that, how much of it is human activity, but let's deal with the second part of that. What are the solutions out there for climate change, and is there some room for debate about the best way to attack it?
So the first thing I think is to challenge that statement. There's some inaccuracy there. There is virtually no debate about the impact, the contribution of anthropogenic activities, human activities in climate change. We have a number of different lines of evidence, so strong that an overwhelming majority, over 97% of experts agree that it's human caused. So one of the deniers' standard positions is that scientists themselves haven't come to a consensus yet. But in fact, there's been an extremely strong consensus for decades in the scientific community. It's just that Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump choose not to listen to the experts. And there are very, very few instances in our lives where we do not listen to experts. But for some reason, an obvious reason, this is one where some people will not listen to the experts.
Okay, so let's operate from the assumption that climate change is caused by human activity, and there are things we should do about it. What are some ideas? And again, is there some debate here that we could really sit here and talk about maybe five different ways to address climate change and try to figure out the best one?
Yeah, Gordon, there's enormous debate about, as we're rapidly reducing carbon emissions, how do we do that? How do we do it most effectively? There's enormous debate about that. But what Scott Pruitt wants to say is, well, there's debate about whether we should really do anything. Or, you know, should we do a little bit or nothing? Or, you know, it's just what he's talking about in terms of debate. You know, the economics of this is very clear. As of 2017, we have enough infrastructure already in place that for the economic life of this infrastructure, if it takes its normal economic life, that will take our planet to 2 degrees Celsius, which is what scientists say we've got to stop before that. So if we don't take action now, then the cost down the road to maintain the safe level is going to increase dramatically. So yes, there are there's debate about how we go about transitioning rapidly to sustainable energy, to non-carbon-based energy, but not the kind of debate that Scott Pruitt seems to have in mind.
Okay, well, let's throw out an idea or two from you two. I mean, if it were just simply the Climate Change Working Group at Western Michigan University, or maybe even more specifically, David Coreau and Paul Clements, what would be the strategy to try and address climate change in order to stop the Earth from getting too warm that we start really having questions about whether or not the human species can survive?
So at the national level, I would immediately shift all subsidies that we currently give to the fossil fuel industry, somewhere between $5 and $15 billion a year, strangely, to the most profitable industry that's ever existed in the history of humanity. I would shift those subsidies to wind and solar. We could produce vastly more energy than we use as a country by either wind or solar. It would take a big scale-up operation, but we have the technologies already. We simply haven't committed the resources to make those available on a national level.
And as we shift those resources, we also need to follow the proposal of the Citizens Climate Lobby and have a revenue-neutral carbon tax where we raise the cost of producing this carbon pollution. We take those resources and we distribute them to every single family in the United States in some kind of equitable way that's going to be progressive, that will use the market, which is what conservatives often have supported, use market forces to lead to more efficient ways to reduce carbon pollution, and it'll be a big plus for most families.
So in other words, there would be a carbon tax, and then in return for that, we, the American people, in some way get a tax cut, because we're probably going to be paying more than for the energy which is produced through fossil fuels.
The overwhelming majority of American families, and particularly low-income families, spend less than the average, because it's the wealthy who are burning more carbon. So if each family either gets a tax cut or a check in the mail or whatever, that's equitable even per family based on population, then the low-income portion of our population will benefit. The people who are creating the carbon pollution will pay more of the cost, and it will lead to, if the tax is a reasonable level, to more rapid movement and efficient movement towards sustainable energy.
We're going to have an interview on the air next week about Donald Trump's promise to bring jobs back in the coal industry and why that's going to be very difficult to actually do because of simply the economics of it right now. But part of that is that it's become fairly easy and not terribly expensive to extract natural gas. Of course, the problem with that is hydraulic fracturing. And the state of Oklahoma, where Scott Pruitt comes from, has seen an increase in earthquakes that most people believe can be linked to fracking. But, you know, what's the overall view of natural gas? I mean, is it a better solution than, say, mining coal or drilling for oil?
It is a somewhat better solution than coal. Coal kills, whereas natural gas does not, because the emissions from coal-fired power plants cause respiratory and cardiovascular difficulties, probably 20,000 heart attacks and 13,000 deaths in the U.S., including a number in Michigan. So it's a little bit better than coal, but it is so much worse than other technologies that we have at our fingertips and just are ignoring. The cost of coal-generated electricity currently is actually higher, considerably higher than solar or wind. Michigan recently bought wind power at 4 cents a kilowatt hour from outside of the state, from Indiana. Coal, if you include the health cost, is about 27 cents per kilowatt hour. So natural gas is still a fossil fuel. It's still a terrible choice relative to others we have available. I would like to see a national effort to dramatically scale up wind and solar and put the plants, the manufacturing plants, in coal country. Let workers in West Virginia have a choice of whether to work in a nice new wind turbine factory or to go underground in the mines and dig for coal. I think it would be an easy choice.
But does it necessarily follow that if you've, you know, worked this long time as a coal miner, that you can then take whatever skills you've had there and put them into helping to run a wind turbine?
I think job training would have to be part of it. But I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but I can imagine that certainly within half a year, you could be you could be qualified to work at most jobs in a turbine factory.
Yeah, there are going to be significant human costs in the transition, and the government needs to step in there to help to address those costs. But the human costs of not making that transition are infinitely, enormously greater. You know, natural gas, it's a carbon fuel. We need to move towards getting off it. But the CO2 per kilowatt hour from coal is much higher than what it is from natural gas. So yes, as a transition, I do think natural gas is a, if you're moving from coal to natural gas on the way to solar and wind, that's the right way to go.
David, we had you on the air about 2 years ago discussing the difference between 2 degrees and 4 degrees warming centigrade, Celsius. Since then, since that time, it was reported that 2015 was the warmest year on record. But then we just found out this week that actually 2016 topped it and was the warmest year on record. There's also some differences there in terms of sort of natural phenomenons that make those numbers even a little more concerning. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. We have been throughout all of 2015 in the first part, but a minority of 2016 experiencing a super El Nino, which tends to make a year a bit warmer than normal.
Is El Nino a natural phenomenon?
Yes, El Nino is a
natural
phenomenon.
Not caused by human activity.
Correct. Okay. Although it is likely that the frequency and severity of El Ninos will increase as a consequence of human-caused warming. It's one of many positive feedbacks in the climate system where changes that warming that we cause creates events that cause even more warming. So all the more reason to get it under control early. But 2016 was the record warmest year, and not by a little, by a huge margin, even though the El Nino was only the first part of the year. So it is even stronger evidence, if any is needed, that there are other than natural phenomena causing warming. Those are burning of fossil fuels and the cutting down of forests.
We have about 30 seconds left, so Paul, I'll turn to you for the last word. What does the Climate Working Group at Western Michigan University plan to be doing once Donald Trump is inaugurated?
Well, for one thing, we're going to be continuing to raise awareness, to teach our students at this university about the realities of climate change, the social impacts. It's going to be affecting their lives. It's going to be, unfortunately, a very challenging part of our students' future. We're going to be educating the community, and we're going to be continuing to be involved in encouraging our citizens to take political action, because that's the way we make the change.
David Corot and Paul Clements, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
The Western Michigan University professors are members of the WMU Climate Change Action Group.
This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. If you're applying for a job or trying to open a bank account or even get a library card, you're probably going to need some ID. But for some people, state identification is out of reach, and so are many essential services. That's led some communities to step in with local ID programs, and Kalamazoo County is considering joining them. Keita Cowan is the director of Synod Community Services in Ypsilanti, which helped create Washtenaw County's local ID program. We spoke by Skype about the benefits of offering a local ID. Keita Cowan, welcome to West Southwest.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to a driver's license or some other kind of state ID, what are some of the reasons that a person might struggle to get one?
One of the first reasons people have difficulty accessing identification through the state is that the state system is predicated on the presence of a birth certificate. And many folks don't have birth certificates. That can stem from a number of reasons. Files are lost, records are misplaced. Older African Americans, particularly from the South, never had a birth certificate because their births weren't deemed worthy of recording. And then more recently in Michigan, the Secretary of State instituted a policy that folks needed to prove that they were in the state and in the country legally in order to qualify for a state ID card or driver's license. And that excluded thousands of undocumented residents who prior to 2008 had been able to access both a state ID card and a driver's license in Michigan.
So it can be a lack of paperwork. It can be because you're an immigrant, but undocumented.
That's correct. I'm sorry. I just wanted to add that I didn't talk about homeless folks who don't have proof of residency in the state because the Secretary of State looks for documents that basically are attached to a home life. So they look for utility records, which you don't have if you're homeless.
What about if you've just been released from prison or jail? Do you does that present any problems for getting a state ID?
Oftentimes now, returning citizens are released without being given either the identification that they entered prison with, nor are they given a new ID card or driver's license when they are released from prison. A lot of folks have been released with just the Michigan Department of Corrections identification card, and the Secretary of State is reluctant to accept those.
Is it likely to be just a handful of people in a community who can't get a state ID?
Well, there's a study that was conducted by the Brennan Center of Justice out of the NYU School of Law, that approximately 11% of all citizens in the United States lack photo ID.
We mentioned before that you might need an ID for applying for a job or opening a bank account. I'm guessing that's just scratching the surface. What are some of the other things you might be excluded from if you don't have an ID?
One of the largest issues in Washtenaw County back in 2014, when the community conversation first evolved about lack of ID, was centered around housing. You now need to, you know, basically produce an ID card in order to rent an apartment, and people without ID are therefore excluded. Employment, you can't complete the I-9 form without proof of identity, and so you don't have the right to work. You need an ID card. Everyone's aware that you need an ID to travel by plane, but a lot of folks aren't aware that both Amtrak and Greyhound require ID, so transportation becomes an issue.
Quite a range of things that you could be entirely cut off from if you don't have some kind of ID card.
Oh, yes. And people are most desperate to get an ID when they have children because you can't pick your child up from school without an ID card.
Really?
And everyone, yes. And everyone knows that you need an ID to access library resources.
This is West Southwest. We're talking about local ID programs with Keita Cowan of Synod Community Services in Ypsilanti. Kalamazoo County is considering creating such a program. Washtenaw started one in 2015. And so if I'm going to apply for a card in Washtenaw, what do I have to do to prove to the county that I am who I say I am?
We've established an objective 300-point verification system that requires, that was established in a manner that allocates a certain number of points to each type of identity credential that you might present. So, for instance, a passport is given a certain number of points. An employer ID is given a certain number of points. a Michigan Department of Corrections ID is allocated a certain number of points. And you need to produce 300 points worth of identity credentials in order to qualify for an identification card. That's the first step. And then the second step is that you need to prove residency.
And so do you find that for residents who can't prove that they're eligible for a state ID, that they can, however, produce enough of those documents to get a Washtenaw ID card?
Yes. Because we use a point system, we aren't focused on the birth certificate. So that allows folks who don't have access to their birth certificates to apply for an ID card. In addition, you can prove residency through a number of means, including a letter from a homeless shelter or social service agency that has been working with you. And we will accept other documents like bank accounts, if you have a bank account records, also the standard utility records. But one of the unique features of the Washtenaw County program, and I hope Kalamazoo adopts this, is that we allocate points for expired state-issued documents as well. So if, for instance, you have an old ID or an old driver's license, the Secretary of State won't accept its own expired documents, but the county will, because obviously the state has vetted you.
In terms of the actual ID itself, I'm pretty much picturing your standard photo ID card. It's got your picture, your name, and maybe your address or something about where you live. Is that about right?
That's true. One of the nice features of our ID is that we have a known-as feature on our identification card, so that individuals that wish to be known by a name other than the name given them at birth can indicate that on the card. So folks who are transitioning to a different identity, it's particularly relevant for transgender folks, can utilize the ID card during that period of time when they're in transition, but before they've had a legal name change.
Once you've decided to issue a local ID, do you still have to get banks and libraries and employers and local governments to sign on? I'm guessing there isn't a legal mechanism for compelling those institutions to recognize the ID?
Well, there is no requirement that a particular institution even recognize a state ID card.
Oh, okay.
So let's start there. Every agency and institution is free to recognize state, federal, and local ID. We worked, before we instituted the program, we worked with law enforcement and other major community institutions so that everyone was on the same page and could agree to accept the identification card as it was being developed. So that's work that had to be done in advance of starting the program.
And do you feel that from banks, for example, that you've gotten a pretty good local buy-in?
Well, we've got, at this point, two banks that have agreed to accept the ID card as the primary source of identification. And we're working to get a broader spectrum of banks, but we were proud that we were able to work with those banks. It's the Ann Arbor State Bank and Old National Bank are the two banks that have agreed to accept the county ID as primary proof of identification. And that gives folks an opportunity to store, to save their money in a safe location. It gives them the opportunity to access credit. I think it was really an important step, and so we were really pleased with those partnerships. It would be great if all of the institutions in town would accept it, but we're going to start with these two banks and work from there.
And have you seen pretty good numbers of residents sign up for the card?
Thus far, it is approximately 1,200 citizens that have signed up for the Washtenaw County ID. I don't have the most recent figures, but I think it's still around 1,200. And we were pleased with that, given that we began this program without a budget and so weren't able to do any advertising. I would say what we need to do going forward is raise the community profile of the program.
I realize this program is still pretty recent, but I'm wondering, are there results or consequences of introducing this local ID that you're hoping to be able to measure? For example, if people are putting their money in banks rather than carrying it around, do you expect to see fewer robberies?
We do. We expect to see fewer robberies. We expect to see a greater percentage of folks reporting crimes and being willing to work with the police, because folks without identification cards are reluctant to contact the police, even when they've been the victims of crime. We anticipate seeing greater participation in civic life. We anticipate seeing increased employment among those communities that are most affected by lack of ID. And it won't surprise anyone to know that marginalized communities are disproportionately affected by the stringent requirements of the Secretary of State. So a greater percentage of homeless folks lack ID, a greater percentage of African-Americans lack ID than even the 11% that we discussed at the beginning of the program. The one estimate has 25% of all African-Americans lack a government-issued ID card, and we need to make inroads to change that.
Did you have anybody raise concerns about costs or confidentiality? Were there some concerns you had to address?
Definitely. When we were developing the program, there were questions about the confidentiality of the database in which names and identities are recorded. But what the community reminded us of is that back in 2008 and before, when, for instance, undocumented folks could access state ID cards and driver's licenses, people were willing to, you know, have their names listed in the state database. And so the idea of being listed in a database wasn't foreign. And folks felt that the county, with its commitment to preserving the confidentiality of the information, made them feel even more secure than they felt when they were in the state database. So it wasn't a new idea, I guess I would say.
And how about the cost to the county of creating the program? I imagine on the one hand, it's not a big expense. On the other hand, sometimes you hear government leaders say, I like that idea, but how do I justify the cost?
Well, the cost depends on the level of equipment that the type of equipment and the level of equipment that you purchase. Washtenaw County, I believe our equipment costs somewhere around $50,000. And that seemed reasonable. I know, given the benefits that we're going to accrue both to the community as a whole and to individuals, it really was a pittance when you think about children having access to the library, creating a level playing field, when you think about homeless folks having access to employment where before they didn't, the cost seems very reasonable. Now, we can compare that with San Francisco, that also has a local ID program, and they spent 10 times that amount on their equipment. So it really depends on the type of equipment and printer that you want to buy.
You mentioned that San Francisco has a local ID program, too. I wanted to make sure we quickly touch on some of the places that have created these. I know Washtenaw County has, and the city of Detroit has as well.
That's correct.
Are there others that I'm leaving out there?
Sure. Let's start with the first, which was New Haven, Connecticut. That was followed by San Francisco, California. More recently, Oakland, California has established its own program. New York City is probably at this point the most famous city with its own local ID program. There is a program in Mercer County, New Jersey. There is a local ID program in Johnston County, Iowa. And now Kalamazoo is considering one.
Keita Cowan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Keita Cowan is the CEO of Synod Community Services in Ypsilanti. We spoke by Skype about why some communities have created local ID cards. You can hear a longer version of this interview at our website. This is West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann.